From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Robert Bader is my guest. He is the editor of a wonderful compilation of writings by the one, the only, Groucho Marx. Originally published many years ago, now revised with several previously unpublished pieces, the book is Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales, Selected Writings of Groucho Marx, an updated and expanded edition. Robert Bader, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
And thank you for collecting these wonderful pieces of Groucho's.
It was an accident that began many, many years ago. I was just really interested in the Marx Brothers and Groucho in particular, and I began going to the public library, just trying to find everything I could lay my hands on, and all those years later, it became a book.
Well, did you ever meet Groucho?
As a fan, not in any kind of sense where we would be friends, but as a 13-year-old kid, I probably stalked him a little bit.
I had a similar experience. I was in a car on Santa Monica, in the passenger seat on Santa Monica Boulevard, and I saw Groucho on his walk. And I said, pull over, pull over, pull over. And I ran about half a block to catch up with him. I said, Mr. Marx, I hate to bother you while you're on your walk, but I've wanted to meet you all my life. He says, I don't blame you.
That's much better than my experience.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that he had this sort of second career as a writer, and he kept it going through his entire career. And he was just friends with writers. He appreciated the written word, and he just was as proud of that stuff as anything else he ever did.
In fact, would you say, I mean, it's kind of an odd thing to say about Groucho, because he was, you know, I think probably the funniest guy that ever lived, and in fact he was so funny that anything he said was funny because he had said it. And yet he craved the attention of being a writer. He felt that maybe he could have been a greater writer, or he hadn't accomplished as much because he wasn't a great writer, something like that.
I think he was self-conscious about having only completed the sixth grade in school, and he probably overcompensated. He was probably more well-read than many college graduates, because I think Dick Cavett actually said that people who go to college only, you know, say they read things. Groucho actually read them, and he was really quite a man of letters, and all of his close friends were writers, and he was always thinking that his show business career was just about at the end, and every time he got into career problems with either the Marx Brothers or on his own, and it didn't look like he was going to continue, he just said, I'll just go back to being a writer, and he continued doing it, even when he would bounce back and the Marx Brothers would get back together, or You Bet Your Life took off, or whatever the next thing was, he continued to be a writer.
And you did find some writings right up in, you know, at the end of his life, right in the 70s.
Yeah, one of my favorite things in the book, really, is an advertisement he did for Teacher's Scotch Whiskey. And I don't think Groucho was much of a Scotch drinker, but they were doing an ad campaign with a lot of famous comedians writing a little testimonial, and Groucho's is really funny. And it ran in a couple of magazines like Playboy and Esquire, and then it was kind of forgotten. And it was just such a well-written, funny piece. And it turns out to be the last piece of its type. He wrote it in 1973. And he didn't do much more like that after that point. And that might be the last published item of that kind.
How much of Groucho's writing was written by Groucho?
You know, almost all of it, in truth. I go into that in the book quite in detail, because Groucho had a man named Arthur Sheikman, who was a close friend, who was a writer for the Marx Brothers at various times, who he allowed to use his name to get some things published, and it created this confusion about whether Groucho used a ghostwriter or not. And the truth is, Groucho didn't need a ghostwriter. There were many wonderfully written things before he knew Sheikman. But Sheikman was having a little trouble getting published, and Groucho was trying to help out a friend by letting him write a few Groucho pieces here and there. And they even co-wrote a few things, and Groucho brought him in as an editor, and he helped Groucho put together some of his books. In fact, Sheikman is the editor of Groucho's book, The Groucho Letters. But the truth is, Groucho wrote the pieces that we have in the book. I didn't use the things that were known to be written by Sheikman.
And how could you tell which things were written by Groucho and which were written by a man who should remain nameless, although his name is Arthur Sheikman?
Yeah, there's correspondence between them where they refer to the pieces as my piece or your piece, and they talk about his agent selling them. Mm. So it's pretty easy. And, you know, once you've read them all, you could sort of see where Sheikman is probably trying occasionally a little too hard to be Groucho, and Groucho calls him on it in some of the correspondence.
How much was Groucho influenced by S.J. Perelman and Robert Benchley as a writer?
You know, that was a question that would probably trigger a really animated reaction from Groucho with reference to Perelman, because they kind of came up together as writers, and Groucho would say, I influence Perelman, and Perelman would say, you know, I influence Groucho as a writer. And they were good friends, and they kind of went back and forth on this for years with a little bit of a minor feud while remaining friends. But I think Groucho's biggest influence as a writer was probably Franklin P. Adams, who really made him want to be more of a writer, and Benchley. All the great humor writers of the period were influenced by Benchley. I believe James Thurber was once quoted as saying he would, you know, a writer's nightmare would be spend a whole night writing some wonderfully witty piece only to find out that Benchley had done it in 1924 much better.
Yeah.
I think Groucho would be, you know, admitting it to be influenced by Benchley, as they all did. But, you know, Perelman wrote for the Marx Brothers, and Groucho and Perelman were very, very similar, and Perelman wrote really, really wonderful lines for Groucho, and, you know, Horse Feathers particularly. So I think it's a mutual admiration society for those two.
You always have to have a dictionary when you're reading S.J. Perelman, because he uses some crazy words, but Groucho doesn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a stylistic difference, but I think their tone is quite similar, and their subject matter, too. I just think they're wonderful to read together. You know, read a little Groucho, read a little Perelman, you could see it.
Harpo is famous for having palled around with the literary crowd in New York at the Algonquin. What about Groucho? Did he hang out with those guys?
He didn't like to be in that situation where everyone was trying to top each other. He didn't like having to be on, and he felt that all those guys were, you know, coming up with these witticisms to make sure they got in the paper, and he didn't really care for that. But he, on the other hand, he did send witty lines to Franklin P. Adams to put in his column. He just didn't like going to lunch and having to try and top Kaufman or, you know, top Benchley. So he stayed away from that, and Harpo was apparently, you know, a great listener who occasionally came up with a great one of his own.
But Groucho did hang out at the Hillcrest Country Club in California with those comedians, Jack Benny and Milton Berle and all those guys, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was a regular at the Hillcrest that he just looked up for the lunch. And, you know, I think he also kind of shied away from it. The Hillcrest wasn't a bunch of guys trying to top each other. It was a bunch of guys who liked to play golf and, you know, eat the same food. I don't think they sat there going at one another. And, you know, maybe the stories of what they did at the Algonquin are, you know, a little bit exaggerated. I don't think they all came to lunch trying to come up with a better joke than the other guy, but Groucho sort of characterized it as that.
Oh, we're talking with Robert S. Bader. His book is called Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales, Selected Writings of Groucho Marx. And this is a new edition. How many new pieces are in this new book?
I've got about a dozen. Actually, maybe it's 11. And some photographs. The original edition was not illustrated. And some of these are items that I've discovered since the original publication, and others were things that I had and held back, either because I didn't feel that they quite fit the format at the time, and some of them were actually pieces that Groucho had written as speeches, and I was trying to stick originally with things that were written to be in print. And for this edition, a couple of those speeches were just too good to leave out. So there are a couple of really wonderful pieces in there where Groucho, you know, had written something to be spoken, and now it's in print.
Well, one of the color pictures that you have in the book, and there's a lot of lovely ones, is a playbill from Minnie's Boys signed by Groucho. Where'd you get that?
At Minnie's Boys.
You got him to sign it for you?
Indeed.
Oh, that's cool. I want that.
Yeah, well, keep looking on eBay.
You might put it up? No, you never would. You'd never part with that, would you?
No,
of course
never.
Not. Of course not. Well, I want to ask about Groucho and Me. I always felt that Groucho and Me, which is a wonderful book that Groucho wrote, it's a wonderful title, a funny title. Groucho and Me, the autobiography of Groucho Marx by none other than Groucho Marx or something like that. But I think it's actually a serious title, that there are two people that occupy the space of Groucho Marx, one being Julius Marx. Do you think that's true? Do you think he had a serious side?
I think he had a very serious side, and I think a lot of people don't understand what his personal life really was. He didn't go out and socialize with the Hollywood crowd. He liked to stay home and read and play his guitar, and it bored his wives to tears, apparently, because they wanted to go out and go to a, you know, party at Clark Gable's house, and Groucho wanted to stay home and read. So he was sort of a dichotomy. He wasn't a traditional movie star in Hollywood's golden age. He was sort of a quiet family guy when he wasn't on stage and screen.
It's funny that you mentioned the guitar, because I love that scene in Horse Feathers where he's riding in the canoe with Thelma Todd and he's playing the guitar, singing Everyone Says I Love You. And he plays great guitar.
Yeah, the Marx Brothers all played musical instruments, and many of them, and quite well. You know, they're all playing the saxophone in a scene in Monkey Business, and you know, Harpo's playing the clarinet. They say that Harpo could pick up just about any instrument and tinker with it for a few minutes and get something wonderful out of it. He was just gifted in that way. And I think all the Marx Brothers had this innate musical talent. They came from a family where, you know, their grandparents had been musicians. So I think Groucho really loved to play the guitar, but he could also play the piano, and, you know, I guess they all played a little bit of saxophone. They were just all able to do it.
Yeah, one of my favorite pieces in the book is a part where Groucho is reminiscing about his past as though he's an old man, although this piece was published before he ever came to Hollywood and ever made a movie.
Well, you know, I love things like that, and what I've discovered since then in working on another book about the Marx Brothers, which will be coming out in 2014,
I found
an interview with Groucho Marx done in 1915,
wow,
in which he reminisces about his long 10-year career in show business.
Isn't that amazing?
And this new book is a book I've written about the Marx Brothers' stage career. It's all about before they got into the movies. So in 1915, he was already looking back at his long career.
So, Robert Bader, were you able to, as you're working on your next book, are you able to reconstruct what their act was like and what we would see if we could see the five Nightingales or whatever they were called?
Well, they were the three Nightingales, then the four Nightingales, and then eventually the six mascots. But yes, I've actually put together a full chronological story of them in vaudeville, where descriptions of the acts from managers' reports and local reviews. But yes, there is a pretty good description of each of their vaudeville acts in there, including a few vaudeville acts that have never been reported before.
And how were you able to do that? What, did you find the scripts of them?
In some cases, yes. I have a couple of early scripts, but I've also spent way more time than I'm going to admit going to local libraries in small towns and digging up whatever I could find.
I'm looking forward to that book. So they were in vaudeville from when until when?
Groucho began in 1905 as a singer and dancer, and they worked vaudeville right up until before they got to Broadway in 1923. They did nothing but vaudeville from 1905 to 1923, and then they were on the Broadway stage for a few years. Different acts. Chico was in vaudeville with three different partners before he actually joined the Marx Brothers. Then Groucho did a few different things on his own before they got together as the Three Nightingales.
And that was a singing group?
Right. The Three Nightingales was Groucho, Gummo, and a fellow named Lou Levy, who was later, Mabel O'Donnell was the original Third Nightingale. Lou Levy replaced her, and then Harpo came in to be the Fourth Nightingale. And in my forthcoming book, you'll learn about a Nightingale that no one's ever heard of. There were actually six different four Nightingales.
Now, Lou Levy, he was the same Lou Levy that became a music publisher later?
No. This Lou Levy vanished without a trace. We don't know where he went.
How sad. What about, now there's a little clip that Marx Brothers collectors might know. It's not from any of their films. It's a little short where they speak in rhyme and do the Chevalier imitation bit that's in Monkey Business, but it's a different version of it because it's all in rhyme. What is that from? Is that from I'll Say She Is?
No, actually, well, yes and no. It was originally conceived in 1921 for a show called On the Balcony, which was written for them by a vaudevillian named Herman Timberg. And that bit stayed in their act for several different shows because they eventually bought Herman Timberg out of the act and took it themselves. They would change the person who they were imitating depending on where they were and who was popular. So that was originally conceived to be an imitation of a performer named Joe Frisco, who has been sort of forgotten. Joe Frisco is actually referenced by F. Scott Fitzgerald in The Great Gatsby to describe a dancer's movements. He was that iconic at the time, but he's now completely forgotten. They would later do it with an imitation of Gallagher and Sheen when they were really popular, and of course Al Sheen was their uncle. Of course they did Chevalier, but when they went over to England, they did a Chaplin imitation.
Huh, wow.
So that was ever evolving, and that bit was filmed when they got to Hollywood to shoot Monkey Business. They didn't really have anything from Monkey Business to do yet. It was still being written, And Paramount was celebrating its anniversary, and they wanted to do this little bit of the Marx Brothers for a film called The House That Shadows Built, which was sent out to the distributors to promote Paramount's anniversary, and it played as a double feature with a bunch of new Paramount films, including Maurice Chevalier's The Smiling Lieutenant. So they did the Chevalier imitation for that reason, and then it was picked up in Monkey Business.
I love it in Monkey Business. When, of course, the best Chevalier imitation is done by Harpo, since he has the phonograph strapped to underneath his coat.
He's really the inventor of the iPod, in a sense.
My name is Sammy Brown, and I just came into town. Saw your ad. You're Mr. Lee. Say, you can make a mint on me.
What do you do?
Dance, sing.
Play a role?
Anything. Say, I'm a fine for guys like you. Of course, there's nothing I can't do.
Tell me, what did you work before?
In a department store.
Who told you you could dance and sing?
Hey, for money, I'll do anything. Why don't you try me? You might as well.
You might be great.
Who can tell?
What do you call your specialty?
You mean my big sensation? I knock 'em cold when I pull off my Chevalier imitation.
Yeah.
If a nightingale could sing like you, they sing much better than they do, 'cause you brought a new kind of love to me. Well, what do you think?
When you go out, don't slam the door. It's a wonderful imitation you gave of Ethel Barrymore.
I'm glad you see me.
Step right in.
Are you Mr. Lee?
My name is Sammy Brown.
Come in. Do you want to talk to me?
I want to talk to Mr. Lee.
I'm Mr. Lee.
That's him.
I see. You want a very good act?
Yes.
Well, I'm the guy you want to guess, and I'll speak very good English, but I'm full of the pep and I got the ambition.
What do you do?
Acrobats.
What's your name?
Familiar. But the best thing I do is give him a taste of Chevalier. When the nightingale may look like you.
That's enough.
When you go out, don't slam the door.
Well, what do you think?
I need a drink.
All right, I take it a drink.
You take the air.
Take the air, he cried.
No like it, the air. It's too cold outside.
Will you please keep quiet?
I no say of the word.
Not an and, a button, or an if. Not a word from you till you're spoken to.
All right, you great big stiff. But...
I'm going to speak to Mr. Lee. I'm a dramatic actor.
So I see. I'm Mr. Lee.
Well, lend an ear to me.
Can you play a role?
Can I play a role? Do you know who you're looking at?
No.
Caesar's ghost. I play any kind of a role.
You will?
Now, eat it up like that. I played a part in Ben Hur once.
What part did you play, sir?
A girl. She played the part of Ben.
And you?
I played her. When you go out, take a slam at the door. You're kidding me, aren't you not?
Kidding, you say. I've been here all day. Now, show me what you've got.
I wanted to play a dramatic part, the kind that touches a woman's heart, to make her cry, for me to die.
Did you ever get hit with a coconut's pie?
There's my argument. Restrict immigration. I think I'll recite.
Let it go, all right.
I'll give you a recitation. Or would you prefer to see me give my Chevalier imitation? When the nightingales could sing like you, they sing much sweeter than they do, 'cause you brought a new kind of love to me. Well, what do you think?
Get me a brick.
Here's a brick. I always carry one for this imitation.
Hey, I ought to lay this on your head.
You can't do that. You don't belong to the Bricklayers Union.
Hey, what do you think you are?
Hey, wait a minute. You know who this is?
No.
He sells Frankfurters. That's the merchant of wieners.
Well, what do you want? My name is What Do You Care? My home is anywhere. People say I'm awful dumb, so I thought to you I'd come. Say, listen, what is it?
Now, just a moment. Wait a minute. He might be crazy. Wait, I'll find out. You want to go on the stage? Crazy.
I wish I could have seen I'll Say She Is. Well, that was their first big Broadway hit in 1923, right?
Yeah, actually, it came to Broadway in 24. They toured it. They toured the country constantly, and it was originally conceived as a big review that had the Marx Brothers as featured guests in it. They were having a bit of a career downturn at the time, and they were blacklisted for various business reasons in vaudeville. They went to work for a competitor of the great vaudeville monopoly that was known as the United Booking Office, and they got into a little trouble. They did that a couple of times. They took this job for this review that was being built up to keep a theater in Philadelphia open for the summer, and they eventually became the stars of that show. They weren't originally conceived as the stars of that show. It became their show later on, and by the time it got to Broadway, of course, it was all them.
What was I'll Say She Is like?
It was a review that had a very flimsy plot. The plot was about a girl who was looking for a thrill, and each of these various characters, four different men, would try to show her different things. It's a really silly plot, but someone would show her the thrill of gambling, and there'd be a gambling sequence, and someone would try to show her, the thrill of love, and eventually love wins out, but she gets to see all these fantasy sequences. The show was actually written around three other failed shows to kind of incorporate the scenery and the songs and the costumes from three other shows. So it was really and truly cobbled together. There was a murder mystery that was one of these failed shows, and in the middle of Alsatia, there's a dream sequence where the main female character is on trial for murder only because they had a courtroom set. But that's actually true. That's what the show was.
Were there any good songs in the show?
Apparently, you know, they were popular. There were a couple of records made of songs, like a song called Only You, but nothing that stuck out as being an iconic Marx Brothers song came out of that show.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Robert S. Bader, and he is an authority on Groucho, and he's just published a selected writings of Groucho Marx called Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales. And also, Robert S. Bader, you have been responsible for editing together a couple of collections of You Bet Your Life DVDs. Isn't that right?
This is true. You've done your research.
Well, I have those collections, and I love them, and I want more. Will there be more?
That's not up to me. If they want more, I'll be happy to do them, but that was a great fun project because we went back and got the original versions of the shows, not the syndicated versions people had seen for years, but we went back to the original film elements, and those shows look terrific on those DVDs.
And there's the commercials and all that, which I love.
Yeah. You know, when You Bet Your Life went into syndication, they, in some cases, they blew up the frame and blurred out the NBC logo for syndication and, you know, cut off the sponsor's name at the top of the picture. So they look kind of crummy in those syndicated prints, but these DVDs, they do look wonderful.
And you worked with Dick Cavett on some of his DVDs too, yes?
Yes, I produced the five different Dick Cavett collections, and what a joy that is to work with that library. Of course, Groucho pops up in there quite frequently. He was on the show, I think, 7 or 8 times, and those are, you know, just a joy. And we'll be eventually doing a Marx Brothers on Television DVD that will probably include one of the Cavett shows we haven't put out yet.
Oh, that would be great. And so there's more. I mean, you know, Dick Cavett was on every night. So where are the rest? Can you get us some more Dick Cavett shows?
We're actually working on that. There's around 2,500 episodes in the archive, and there is some work being done right now with the Library of Congress on those masters, and we're in the process of doing something really, really interesting that will become more known. I'm not being secret. I just don't quite know how we're going to do it yet, but it's being worked on now by greater minds than mine.
Well, there's another appearance with Groucho on Dick Cavett that hasn't come out yet that I remember well when the Minnie's Boys cast and Shelley Winters were on the show with him. And
that is a wonderful show, and that's one of the ones I would really hope to get out in the future with that Marx Brothers set. That would be a great inclusion there.
I remember Groucho that
night. You should be producing that set.
Okay. I remember Groucho that night saying, you're only as young as the women you feel.
Yeah, and you know what's really great? The night that that show was on, he was also on The Tonight Show. They taped him. Yeah, it might have been Merv Griffin. He was on two of the late night shows literally at the same time to promote that because of the way they taped them.
That's funny. Now, that was really, you know, there was a period when he was on Dick Cavett. That was really kind of the last great performances of Groucho, because Groucho, and I know there's a record of his wonderful Carnegie Hall show that he did, and then he fell ill. But by the time he came, I was lived in Los Angeles, and I saw him do his show at the Music Center. But by that time, he had had a series of strokes and was not really at his best.
Well, what happened on that tour, he was supposed to do a longer tour, and two of the shows were canceled outright. Los Angeles was originally canceled, and it was done many months later.
Right.
He was touring in the spring of 72 and did the first show in Iowa, then he did San Francisco and New York, and New York was apparently his worst show, and the album is really cobbled together from San Francisco and Iowa with bits of the New York show in it. The L.A. show was done after the album had come out,
right,
and Chicago and Detroit were canceled and never done. He just wasn't up to touring, and, you know, he was 82 years old at the time. Not many 82-year-olds tour, but that was an album I grew up on. I've got every syllable of it committed to memory. It's just one of those things I listened to over and over again as I was becoming more and more of a Marx Brothers fan. His stories about vaudeville life on that album are just treasures.
Oh, it's a wonderful record. And there's also a record, or a series of records, that he recorded for Decca where he sings some of his great songs, and I love that, too.
Yeah, that was done around 1952, and it's just a joy. I wish there was more of it. Back then, an album was a 10-inch thing with 8 songs on it. I just wish he would have done more of that. It's wonderful stuff.
I love it. It's so great. He does Go West, Young Man from Copacabana, and he does
Well, that's got Dr. Hackenbush on it, which never was actually filmed. It was supposed to be in A Day at the Races, but that's the version of Dr. Hackenbush that we're left with.
Right, right, that's right. That's funny. There's a song in, and you being a Marx Brothers expert, I'm going to ask you about this. There's a song in the end of A Day at the Races when they have the finale and they sing little bits of the songs they've been singing all night. And Groucho sings a little bit of a song that was not in the movie.
I've got a message from the man in the moon.
I've got a message from the man in the moon.
Now, you didn't tell me what these questions were going to be, so you know I'm on the tightrope here. But, yeah, that was cut out of the film, and it was too late to cut it out of the medley because it was already recorded. So the songs in the medley are not all in the film, as you can tell.
Is there a version of that song somewhere that Groucho sings?
If there is, it's not turned up yet, and I would have thought somebody at MGM would have found it and put it on one of those wonderful CDs they've done of MGM musical stuff, so I'm guessing it's not around. I would love to find it, but I don't think so.
It is odd that although they've released, they've released the five Paramount films on DVD, you know, a dozen times, and they never put any extras like that little sketch that we were talking about from Vaudeville.
You know, it's kind of an odd thing to say, but sometimes the people at the studios aren't even aware of what they have. They should have put that on certainly on the Monkey Business DVD. I can't explain why they didn't. They certainly should.
Well, it's up to you. You're got to get over there. You're the DVD guy.
Yeah,
get over there and kick their ass, Robert.
I'll try really hard to get that actual piece on something really soon because it's a wonderful, wonderful example of what the Marx Brothers might have been like on stage. That they did that routine probably 1,500 times on stage.
There's a version of it that is in the movie, the documentary that Gene Kelly narrated, The Marx Brothers in a Nutshell, and that's lovely, but it's not the complete thing. And then there's I have a VHS tape that has the complete thing, but it's really a grainy.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same version. It's the filmed version for The House That Shadows Built, the Paramount compilation.
Yes, but a different.
Yeah,
print.
Different levels of quality, apparently. Yeah. I once owned an 8mm copy of it. You know, there's been something, you know, waiting to happen. Someone should put that out. That needs to be seen.
Well, fit it. Can't you fit it on your Marx Brothers on TV? I guess not.
Well, you know, I'll do what I can. No promises, but I'll try.
You can just say Gary Shapiro insists that we put this on.
I'll actually have to get you involved in this.
Well, what about Bill Marx has been a guest on the show. He's Harpo's son. I know you know him. Has he been a help to you?
He's great. I love Bill Marx. He's been really just a joy. Actually, in the work I've been doing on my Marx Brothers vaudeville book, Bill was gracious enough to let me go through a scrapbook kept by the brothers in the early days, which Harpo ended up with somehow, and it's got clippings from around 1908 to 1920, and it has a lot of rare photographs in it, some of which will be reproduced in my forthcoming book. It is really just a magnificent treasure, and I believe he might have put it in the Smithsonian. It's a wonderful thing, and he let me have full access to it. And, you know, just his time and talking to him about his dad and his uncles, he's been just a great source for my research and just a good friend. I just love the guy.
Well, if you're a Marx Brothers fanatic like Robert Bader and myself, then you must have this book called Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales. And if you're not a Marx Brothers fanatic, then you will be after you read this book because it's got some great stories. Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales, Selected Writings of Groucho Marx, an updated and expanded edition. Robert S. Bader, thank you so much for spending some time talking Marx Brothers with me.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you, Gary.
That's all the time we have this week on From the Bookshelf, but I hope you'll come back and see us again next week for another good show. In the meantime, check us out on the web at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. You can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Robert S. Bader. He is the editor of Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales, Selected Writings of Groucho Marx, updated and expanded edition. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.